Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today is day, 10, 12, something like that in the case of, I can't count. Dal Dearman is in the control room telling us what day it is, the case of our fun drive, maybe day 9. And if you have not made a contribution yet, it is time to do so, ladies and gentlemen. Listener-supported public radio requires that our listeners give a call, and the number is 505-428-1393, hey. 505-428-1393. Good morning, Dal.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. I just was, I'm sorry, I missed my cue. I was just picking up some other thank yous from the phone room. I want to thank Nancy Henderson. Nancy, thanks so much for your call just moments ago. From Taos, Melissa Carson. Thank you very much, Melissa, who operates the Holy Rags Shop in Taos. And Fran, it's a little more complicated, but Fran would like to donate a Ron Davis CD she received as part of her donation on Sunday during the Folk Remedy Show to the next student who donates to KSFR. Ron Davis was great, by the way. So let's see. We've got those. We've got some others, too, but I don't have them right here now. I'll get back to you with those. But we are, we're picking things. Steam is picking up this morning. 428-1393 is the number to call. And Mary Charlotte, I'm glad you're here.
We are always happy to be here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. And listener-supported public radio, ladies and gentlemen, is a very good thing in your life. Probably most of you are listening. Listen every day on the way to work. It's spring break now for a lot of people, so maybe you're at home staggering out of bed and making coffee, whatever it is you're doing. We really would like to ask you very respectfully but also insistently to pick up the phone, 428-1393. Make a call. Make a quick pledge to KSFR.
I have some more thank yous, too.
Excellent.
Ellie, thank you, Ellie, for your call this morning. Darcy Crenshaw. Darcy, thanks for calling KSFR with your pledge. Joella Foreman from Los Alamos. Joella, thank you so much. One of our favorite Los Alamos listeners. And Christine McCoy. Christine, thanks for calling KSFR and helping us with the spring pledge drive. So this is good. Good start to the show.
And let's keep it up. I'm delighted right now to welcome poet David Wojahn. He is visiting Santa Fe. His book of poetry, Interrogation Palace, New and Selected Work, 1982 to 2004, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and he directs the program in creative writing at Virginia Commonwealth University, and he teaches in the MFA writing program of Vermont College of Fine Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And you will be here tonight speaking at 5:30 in the O'Shaughnessy Performance Center here in the College of Santa Fe, and it is the final event in the first print series. And Matt Donovan, who is a professor of creative writing and literature at the College of Santa Fe, also joins us. Welcome.
Hi there.
So tell us for a moment about the first print series. It's been going for a long time.
It's been going for just over 20 years now. It was started by Greg Glazner, who also founded the creative writing program at the College of Santa Fe. And we have had just a stellar run and a stellar group of writers that have been coming through several times each semester. We've had MacArthur Fellows, we've had National Book Award winners, we've had Edward Albee, Peter Matheson, Dennis Johnson, Barry Hanna, and then on the poetry front, we've had Robert Haas, Golly Cannell, Louise Glick, Jory Graham. And also some up-and-coming writers as well. John DeGatta, a few years back, gave a tremendous reading that our students are still talking about.
That's saying something.
That they're still talking about it?
Yeah.
It really resonated with them. And, that has been, I think, the motivation for a lot of the writers that we brought in, that we've picked them according to who we thought the students would really be able to listen to, get something out of in terms of their own writing, respond to, and just have a really stellar force on campus. With David, what we've done is a few years ago we started a writer-in-residence series, and that is through a generous grant from the Witter-Binner Association, Foundation, rather. And so David will be on campus doing class visits all week long, and we're tremendously lucky to have him doing that, and then he'll be giving his reading tonight. And as you said, it's 5:30. It's free in the O'Shaughnessy Performance Space on the College of Santa Fe. And because the college is closing on May 22nd, David will also be the very last reader for our first print series after 20 years. So we feel really honored and lucky to have him here, and I think it'll be a great way to end the series as well with David. I can't imagine a better writer to end it with as well.
Well, I've been reading your poetry, and it's great. It's very interesting to read on many levels. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen of the Fund Drive Haven't Donated Yet universe out there, you can get actually a copy of his book, Interrogation Palace, which is what, as I said, was the finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. We have 5 copies of that, and we have copies of some of the other work as well. If those sell out, please give a call at 205-428-1393 and make a donation. When Matt was just reading out this list of names of people who've been there, there's a very good chance that most of the people who are listening haven't heard of most or even any of those poets. And it's striking the contrast between how powerful a medium poetry is and how little it's respected in this country. And that's something that you, I think about quite a bit, and also every poet has to work out.
Yeah, the NEA recently did a survey on reading habits in the country, and they compared it to the survey they did in 92, the survey they did in, I think, 2002. And actually, the readership for serious literary fiction has gone up a little bit, but the readership for poetry, which was never very high to begin with, has gone down. And, you know, I don't know the reasons for that. You know, poetry will always be a kind of endeavor that might have a kind of niche audience that most of the people who seriously read poetry are always also people who write it. So it's not as
if... But that's not necessarily true in other places in the world.
No. I mean, people like Pablo Neruda could fill a football, a soccer stadium.
And his audience was working class people. It was everybody.
And I think, you know, endeavors like National Poetry Month, which starts tomorrow, are an attempt to try to reconnect poetry with an audience. You know, Whitman famously said that to have great poetry, you need great audiences. And I just think that what's really going to help in the future for poetry and what it can do in the next century is that we develop a greater reading audience of intelligent literary people who go to poetry for pleasure or go to poetry for some sort of consolation. And I think right now it's the readers of poetry or the writers of poetry. And that's good, but it also makes things a little insular sometimes.
It also puts you in a very strange position when you're writing political poetry or poetry of protest that no one's listening to the protests.
Yeah, this was especially something that happened, you know, when there was such a terrific upsurge in poetry of social protest along about 2003 when the Iraq War started. And on the one hand, you know, if I write a scurrilous poem about George W. Bush, nobody is going to listen to me. I'm not going to be like a poet in Soviet Russia who would do that and be in a labor camp in a few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixed thing. You're not going to end up in the gulag.
No, which is a good thing. But I think that just a sense of being, you know, one of the things that's political about poetry is it's simply that it insists that people have a rich private inner life. And that is communicated by the poet on almost any level in almost any kind of poem. And that usually communicates to an audience as well. And, you know, I think what poetry does insist upon is that, you know, when you read a book of poems, you feel like you're having a one-to-one communication between the author and the reader. It's like the two of you in that room, in that space alone. And when that happens, you're no longer a consumer, you're no longer a demographic. You know, it humanizes you in a way that even a lot of other art forms don't. It's And I think that may have something to do with the fact that despite poetry slams and all sorts of efforts that I think are good efforts to make poetry more accessible to a larger public, you know, fundamentally so much of the process of writing and reading is one-on-one. It's like two people in intense close-up when you're reading a poem or writing a poem for that imaginary reader.
So there is an issue that you bring up in this wonderful essay that I was reading last night called Maggie's Farm No More, The Fate of Political Poetry, is that a lot of political poetry comes from the heart, but it's really bad. Even the poems of really good poets can be some of their most mediocre work when they get on a soapbox and start doing political poetry.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
And what makes something, I was thinking about this, and I think about this a lot, what makes something bad if somebody in that private space of one-on-one reader and page is, especially a young person who's finding themselves politically, is inspired by it?
Well, I think that the really good political poems that I can think of over the years and over the centuries, I think of a poem like Robert Lowell's For the Union Dead, are poems where the writer makes a very strong effort to have a strong personal connection with a public event. They become poems where public history and private history merge. Otherwise, they're just rhetoric. You know, a lot of Yeats's poems, though sometimes his politics were a little unsavory, have that same kind of effect on people, that the difference between the self-writing of the poem and the self that cares about politics and change is not that great.
Oscar Wilde's great line was, all bad poetry is sincere.
It's sincere, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And it does speak to some people, which means that it's having an effect, which means that it is not useless. I mean, good doesn't equal useless, but still.
No, and you know, and the other thing about poetry, too, that in this rampantly consumerist society, the very fact that it's impossible to make a living alone as a poet. Most poets teach in the academy. It's not a career you can ever engage in thinking you can make a living from it. But, you know, in some ways that very fact that it's a benign influence, it's not an influence that, you know, when my students decide whether they're going to go to an MFA program or law school or medical school, you know, at least I know if they choose to take a career in poetry, they're going to be poor for the rest of their lives. But it's a completely benign endeavor. Nobody ever, you know, was damaged for writing a bad poem.
So at the same time, you have a very powerful medium, namely popular music in its many manifestations, that has the just on the other end of the spectrum ability to influence people.
Absolutely.
And contains, if not poetry, lyrics.
And, you know, I'm a fanatical listener to rock and roll music from the 50s onwards. And, you know, a lot of lyrics from popular music from the last half century have had more of an impact on me as a poet than a lot of poetry. And I think a lot of the poets in my generation have been very much like that, too. I mean, I don't think any baby boomer poet started writing poetry. They probably started listening to Bob Dylan and finding out who Rimbaud was or finding out who Nietzsche was from liner notes to Highway 61 Revisited. So,
that your story?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's replicated hundreds of times with people in my approximate age group. That, you know, he was in many ways the gateway.
Now, would you consider him a poet?
No, I'd consider him Bob Dylan. You know, and he's in a class by himself. So, and it wasn't so much that a lot of Dylan's lyrics can stand on their own without musical accompaniment. And I think when people try to apply that standard to him, they're getting it all wrong.
We're talking to David Wojahn. He is a poet who will be tonight at the College of Santa Fe at 5:30 doing a free reading. It's the final event of the first print series. And ladies and gentlemen, please give a call and score a copy of his very wonderful book of poetry, especially if you're not used to reading poetry. This is something I had a friend, and I was actually reading some of the work aloud, and of course that's another experience and a wonderful thing to be able to do. The number at the pledge drive is 505-428-1393.
Hey, I'm here with a lack of progress report.
I'm just going to give the number again.
Okay.
505-428-1393. The phones are quiet.
The phones are quiet. We need to get listeners to be calling our phone room and making some pledges. By the way, we did make, I didn't mention this before, we did make our $1,500 match this morning, which I want to thank everybody who participated in that between 6 and 8. That was a wonderful kickstart to the day. We just need to keep this going now during the Radio Cafe, which I know we can do because Mary Charlotte is so popular and has so many, and she does, I mean, has so many listeners every morning and does such a wonderful job in a whole variety of subjects. The Radio Cafe is an education. A lot of people tell me that it's an education for... didn't somebody say yesterday, I don't need to read the book now because you talked about it so well? It's something like that.
Whatever.
Yeah, but anyway.
But the thing is, today in particular is actually a very good day to call and get a copy of the book, 505-428-1393. We are listener-supported public radio. If you haven't called yet, just do it now so that I don't have to keep asking you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. And if you are a little person and your parents are there, knock on their knees right now and get them to go to the telephone, 428-1393. David Wojahn, when you talk about your poetry being influenced by the music of the 60s,
yeah.
Do you have any poems you'd like to read that you think might illustrate that?
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to say, however, before I did that in regard to Pledge Week, that you know a lot of NPR affiliates really, because of budget cuts and a lot of other reasons, aren't paying attention to the community they serve in the way that, you know, they used to. They pick up the national programs like All Things Considered, but they don't pay the same sort of attention to the community they serve. And it's really great to see a program like yours being broadcast, because I think that's what NPR has always been about, but it isn't about that so much anymore in other affiliates.
There are many, and we're not actually strictly NPR. We carry the BBC, yeah. But we are community-supported public radio, and which is very similar, same basic idea. And we really have a commitment to local programming. We, of course, carry the BBC because people want that national and international voice, not to mention the point of view that is from England. The BBC does an amazing job. And we do have some programs that are syndicated programs like Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which people love. But then so much of the rest of it is locally produced shows, much of it by almost all of it by volunteers. I'm here every day, so I'm not a volunteer, but it feels like it sometimes. 428-1393. 428-1393 is the number. Please give a call right now if you like this show. So back to the question of poetry born of the experience of the 60s.
Okay. About 20 years ago now, I wrote a book-length series of poems, actually. They're all sonnets about kind of the connections between popular music and history. History approximately in the Cold War era. So I can read a couple of them. This one actually about Bob Dylan. And you might remember that his great idol was Woody Guthrie, that he really tried to imitate the walk, the talk, the mannerisms of Guthrie when he first came to New York in the 60s. And at that time, Guthrie was wasting away of Huntington's cholera in a hospital. So this is a kind of apocryphal story about Dylan coming to the hospital to see his idol. It's called Woody Guthrie Visited by Bob Dylan, Brooklyn State Hospital, New York, 1961. He has lain here for a terrible motionless decade and talks through a system of winks and facial twitches The nurse props a cigarette between his lips, wipes his forehead. She thinks he wants to send the kid away, but decides to let him in. He's waited hours. Guitar case, jean jacket. A corduroy cap slides down his forehead, doesn't talk. He can't be more than 20. He straps on the harmonica holder, tunes up, and begins his song to Woody, trying to sound three times his age. Sandpaper, dust bowl, growl, the song interminable, inept. Should he sing another? The eyes roll their half-hearted yes. The nurse grits her teeth, stubs out the cigarette.
It's an amazing moment. When you say it's an apocryphal story, is that a story that people tell about?
Well, I know he visited Guthrie a lot in the hospital.
A lot.
And so, you know, with this series, some of it is completely apocryphal. Some of it is based absolutely on fact, and some of it is in that gray area between. And it just gave me a lot of latitude to stick to fact and also to invent.
Well, a story like that, a poem like that is so interesting to me. I was really struck by it when I was reading your work yesterday, that these two people who are now icons are capable of meeting and not connecting.
Or connecting in a very, you know, in a meaningful but very minimal way. And that always strikes me as an interesting sort of human situation. You don't always know what those moments of intensity and radical transformation are when they happen.
Exactly.
And it seemed like that was a moment I wanted to focus on in the poem.
And there's one about a very early Beatles, pre-Ringo Starr Beatles concert in Germany, which also kind of falls flat.
Yeah. I mean, with any sort of art form, it takes a long time to develop some kind of expertise. And I'm always interested in, you know, the passion and earnestness of people who can't really play instruments or people who can't really write being so devoted to what they're doing that eventually they learn.
Do you think that was the case with the Beatles?
I think it was. Yeah, you hear some of those old tapes that they did in the Cavern Club in, you know, in Germany in the 50s, and you really see them soaking in every kind of musical, you know, popular musical form that's available to them at that point. But it's a long and slow process.
We're talking to David Wojahn. So when you... It's funny, when you make these poems about... would you like to read another before
okay,
we talk
I'll
about
read
it?
Would that
you like
poem
to read a couple
if you'd
of,
like, yeah.
Yeah, not necessarily the Beatles one, but anyone from that series about music and musicians.
Okay, here's one. Actually, it's near the end of the series, and it's called The Assassination of John Lennon as Depicted by the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum.
Now, first of
Niagara
all...
Niagara Falls, Ontario.
Is that for real?
This is a very odd story, but I made the whole thing up and then found out there actually was a Madame Tussauds tableau of this event.
No.
So it was a real strange synchronicity.
No, it's poet as prophet. Go ahead.
Okay, The Assassination of John Lennon as Depicted by the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, Niagara Falls, Ontario, 1987. Smuggled human hair from Mexico falls radiant upon the waxy O of her screen. Shades on, leather coat and pants, Yoko on her knees, like the famous Kent State photo, where the girl can't shriek her boyfriend alive, her arms windmilling Ohio sky. A pump in John's chest heaves to mimic death throes. The blood is made of latex, his glasses broken on the plastic sidewalk. A scowling David Chapman, his arms outstretched, his pistol barrel spiraling fake smoke, and a siren's red wash completes the composition. And somewhere, background music plays Imagine before the tableau darkens. We push a button to renew the scream. The chest starts up again.
David Wojahn, the The book of poems is called Interrogation Palace. And ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, please give a call right now, 505-428-1393. So that's it's a whole series of poems about those people and your imaginings of them. Some of them, of course, like Janis Joplin, are long dead. Quite a number of them are long dead. And the rest are not forgotten, but they're just, I mean, it does make one think about what they're doing now, what their experience of life is right now after this era is long gone.
And a lot of them have fallen into complete obscurity, too, which is sad. But I focused in that series pretty much on about the mid-50s through the mid-70s, partly because that seemed like such a turbulent time for American culture, and it was, I think, the first time when rock and roll music became the soundtrack for that turbulence. So it was a very specific focus on a very specific and really interesting period.
So let's go back to this question of the relationship between protest and the effectiveness of the protest. There's this community of poets, and I think somewhere in this essay you talk about, you ask whether the community is really a community. Is there a community of poets who are engaged in a joint activity of some kind?
Collectively, there was a website called that the poet Sam Hamill formed in shortly after the beginning of the Iraq War, called Poets Against the War. And if you access that website, it continues to have thousands upon thousands. I mean, something like 19,000 poems posted on it that talk about the failure and corruption of American foreign policy in general during the Bush administration, but specifically about the war. And not all the poems on that site are good. Maybe the majority of them are not good, but just the whole gesture of doing that was, I think, something that brought the community of poetry together in ways that it hasn't before. So, poetry is one of the most conservative of the arts, and I don't think poetry has really caught up with some of the possibilities of the web yet.
Mm-hmm.
But that was...
When you say it's conservative, what do you mean?
Well, because I don't think it changes as quickly or as radically as, say, music or even dance, painting. It changes, but somehow it moves a little at a slower pace. And I think it's always been that way that in the early part of the century, radical transformations were being made in the visual arts, in music, and it was only then that poets picked up on those sorts of possibilities. So they sort of translated a modernism from other art forms into poetic endeavor.
And so, but again, getting back to this sense of being engaged in something together, I mean, there certainly is in the modern visual art movements that contain lots of people who were both learning from each other and to some extent competing against each other. What's it like in poetry? I mean, how do you relate to one another?
Well, there are like umbrella organizations like the Associated Writing Programs, which are meant to be something that brings together poets from, basically academic backgrounds from all the creative writing programs in the country. And there are some 300 of them. They have an annual convention. And, in some ways, because poetry is so cultish, you go to those conventions and it seems like you're going to a Shriner's convention or a gynecologist convention. There's everything except the wearing of the fezes in it. But it gets back to that notion that poets crave community, they crave an audience, they crave a readership, but poetry is also an intensely private endeavor. And I think it's very hard to bridge that gap, though poets again and again have tried. But I think it's an essential paradox about poetry as opposed to other art forms. The intense privacy of it and then, the intense desire to play on a public sphere with it, too. And I've, over the years, some people find that paradox frustrating, but for me it's often been one that is compelling enough so a lot of my work just seems to emerge from that.
We're talking to poet David Wojahn, who is visiting Santa Fe and is going to be tonight at 5:30 at the O'Shaughnessy Performance Space in a free event at the College of Santa Fe.
And
I'm going to take a little break right now to check in with the control room.
And we just had a call from a gynecologist. I'm kidding. I want to thank Janet Berry. Janet walked in just moments ago with a check. I love instant gratification. That is so nice.
Thank you so much.
And also, Celia Sparling. Celia Sparling, thank you, Celia,
thank
for your
you,
contribution.
You.
And she says to say hi to you.
Thank you very much.
Yep. And we need some more calls.
428-1393 is the number, 428-1393, listener-supported KSFR Public Radio. And you can get one or more books of David Wojahn's quite amazing poetry if you call and make a contribution right now. Once again, 505-428-1393. And if you're calling from out of area, it's 1-866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR. So there's an interesting moment in your essay on political poetry where you talk about MFA programs, Masters of Fine Arts programs in poetry, and how they really encourage competence over risk-taking. And what's that about?
Well, you know, I have to say as a disclaimer, I teach in two MFA
yeah,
programs.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So, but I think it's possible to critique those things from the inside. And I guess so much of what happens when you're a young poet is that you're learning the craft, you're learning technique, you're learning to find a way to make the words work in terms of poetry. And then there gets to be, I guess, a challenge that you make of how do you make the words work and how do you make them work in a really urgent level. And I think that the good thing about MFA programs is that they've created, you know, probably a much larger number of pretty good poets in America right now than probably have ever existed at any time in the past. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's created great poets. It doesn't necessarily mean that the number of poets who will really be remembered 100 or 200 years from now is any greater than it ever was in the past. So I
think the number of anything that will be remembered is very small.
Yeah. So I think there's nothing wrong with making, you know, thousands of people who graduate from MFA programs every year competent writers, good writers. None of us today really are great writers, but that's how it's always been.
So talking about this conversation between personal authenticity and response to politics, I was reading your essay and then I thought, you know, all the things that you're criticizing poetry for not being, the very first poem in your book is a beautiful and stellar example of what you seem to be trying to get poetry to be. I was wondering if you might read it.
Oh, sure. I have a pair of 7-year-old twin boys, and they, and I remember a weird synchronicity in 2003 of watching, while I was taking care of them, watching CNN and seeing the war just begin. So in some ways, the connection's obvious to see some horrible, mindless, stupid event being pushed forward at the same time that you're trying to bring out the first words of your children. And so, you know, both of those things jibe together. There's also another thing that happens in the poem is that there's a lot of discussion about cranes, the bird, the crane. And, you know, they're all very much endangered now. And for years I'd had tacked up to my desk a picture of a zookeeper dressed in a costume of a whooping crane because they didn't want the fledglings that they'd raise in captivity to imprint upon human beings. They wanted them to imprint upon other cranes. So it's this beautiful picture of this guy dressed to look like a crane with like a probably a parachute and, you know, a fake nose. And
did that work?
I don't know. But it's you know, but there's also that sense of so much of what, you know, happens in our culture today has to do with endangerment of one sort or another. So in essence, it the poem became George Bush, whooping cranes, my children, and, you know, the board books the children play with, which, you know, they're often the touch and feel kind that have real fur on it. So,
and also the squirrel, which you'll hear about in a moment, but a few minutes ago you said something about squirrelless poems about George Bush, and I was thinking, what about squirrelless poems?
Squirrelless poems, yeah. He's in here. And, you know, I'm also kind of relieved that I don't have to write many George Bush poems anymore.
Yeah, it must be a relief.
Yeah. But it's called Board Book and the Costume of a Whooping Crane. Two new words a day and sometimes three. Cup and doll. Yesterday, throat and hot, hot, hot. The tea extended. Hot. Fingers drumming the radiator. He's 13 months. Hand to the windowsill. Head tilted up to glimpse a squirrel. Freshly changed, he squeals as inches from his face the squirrel stares toward him, its eyes a shrouded planet, cloud cover seen from space, monsoon roiling the Pacific. And his brother, laughing, tackles him, squirrel leaping down to snow. If learning is delight, then Gnosis asks unshroudings more laborious, the hard unspooling, the rended gauze, and everywhere the shrouds, and everywhere the shrouds to come. The president's rodent eye pulses out from CNN, darting and glazed, squinting for the next thing to lift to the mouth, for he must eat and eat. As the boys sit down to sift through board books, the grim hand jitters up from the podium, class ring in a dazzle of pixels. Today he will entertain no questions, impatient for the killings to begin, executions to roll on his tongue like acorns, berries purpling the gaping mouth. Already he can taste them. Now the cutaway to ordnance and acronym, F-16 snarling up from a carrier, the Moab with its 21,000 pounds of murder. But here, a board book of cranes open and a flutter in Luke's hands. And now Jake joining him, touch and feel, so his fingers stroke a tuft of feathers, orange rubbery hieroglyphic of a foot. Sandhill crane, damsel crane, black crown, gray crown, wattled and blue, Saurus Siberian, hooded and white next, Eurasian, red crowned Australian and Eastern Saurus, and Grus Americana, whooping crane, almost extinct for a century, numbers dwindled by DDT, by power line and coyote, drought and poachers selling ground up bills, to Beijing and Macau an antidote for hair loss, until scarcely 100 remain, hatched and fledged in captivity. Also here, the photo I've tacked above my desk, a zoo attendant in the costume of a whooping crane, cumbersome in bird mask, a parachute gathered to make a kind of overall. He's bending to a nest of fledglings, beaks agape and waiting, released to the wild, few of them survive for long. The boys sift the pages, hands brailing yellow beaks. The president hisses on, martial music seeping from marine band horns, the snow in thickening spirals. I am suiting up, the costume clumsy as a space suit, white silk billowing the lemon-colored boots' ridiculous clown's feet, and the mast pasted tight with sweat and the ache of my ascending. I sprout Ovidian claws. My eyes look down on miles of stratosphere. The piston work of wingbeat and outstretched glide, the long wail echoing from the throat, the fish within my jaws struggling still, circling the gyres diminishing to touchdown, and my gangling stagger toward them who will lavishly outlive me, and from my mouth this rainbow, wet and silvering.
David Wojahn, from his book of poems, Interrogation Palace. That's a why did you start the book with that one?
Just because I wanted to start the book with a new poem and a section of new poems. A lot of selected poems start with the old poems and reach the new poems first. And I wanted to sort of break that pattern. And, you know, I also wanted it to be a poem about legacy, not just my legacy, but my kids' legacy. And, you know, in some ways it was an exercise because the corniest cliche in poetry is poets wanting to be birds. And I figured I wanted to somehow address that because the end, damn it, I've become a bird. You know, you hear all these poems about poets wanting to be birds. You never hear poems about birds wanting to be poets.
Or poets wanting to be hippopotamuses.
Right.
So, I was thinking also when I was reading it, well, a couple of things. And one is that there's so many little facts that you learn in poems, like ground up bills of cranes are used as baldness remedies
yeah.
in China.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, you know, there are so many weird special facts that I love to get into the poems, not because they're just simply oddball sorts of things that you'd find in a YouTube video, but simply things that can turn into poetry if they're combined with the right things.
Do you feel like you have an obligation to have those little facts that are thrown in like that be true?
Some of the time, not all of the time.
So you can take poetic license. So basically, the reader really doesn't know. If they have to look it up.
Well, hopefully they don't have to look it up unless they want to. I mean, I don't want the poems to seem so arcane or hermetic or obscure that you have to rely on references that you have to really study.
Well, that, of course, gets into, I mean, that's another issue, but it gets into the problem of poetry being arcane and being for other poets, which certainly has been, I mean, I remember in college reading contemporary poetry and thinking, why didn't they just say it? Why do they put it into this code
right.
that I have to take 3 years of English to even understand what they're saying?
You know, in some respects, though, poetry should be difficult. If it isn't difficult, then you're not going to be inclined to, say, take a Wallace Stevens poem and read it over and over and over again over years, over decades, and see something new emerging from it all the time. I guess it's the question of having a good poem needing to submit to that standard, but also that every time you read that good poem, it moves you emotionally or viscerally. So I think it's a combination of the two. You know, the difficulty, the obscurity is what keeps you going back to the poems. But if it's just difficulty and obscurity, it's not going to want to do that.
What about poets like Neruda? Do you think those are difficult and obscure?
Well, you know, they're a period. I mean, Neruda wrote 50 books of poems,
right.
And he went through a lot of phases in his career. And because he wrote so many thousands of pages of poetry, some of his poems are good. A lot of them are pretty bad. But even the bad ones are interesting. And I think that at times his poems are, you know, highly hermetic and highly esoteric. At times they're very, very public and direct. And I think he was one of those rare writers who would write one kind of poem one day and another kind of poem on another. You know, he didn't feel like he needed to be consistent in his subject matter or his style from day to day.
Now, getting back to the question of risk-taking, what about the poets who are learning their craft? Are they willing to be one thing on one day and one another?
Well, they should be, I think. There's almost a cliche in writing programs that your goal when you get out of an MFA program is to, I think the term that's often used is find your voice. And, you know, I had a teacher once who really railed against that notion because, you know, sometimes if you find your voice, you're stuck with it.
Right.
And, you know, I want to, at my age, you know, I've tried to write a lot of different kinds of poems over the years. I want to continue to write a lot of different kinds of poems over the years. I know that my poems arise from my obsessions, and I don't think very many people have very many obsessions. You have a small number of them, and I think the trick in a writing career or a poetry career is you just find new ways all the time to deal with your obsessions. So in some ways it's very limited, and in some ways it's very liberating because you can find through technique ways to say different things about the things you always want to say.
Do you find that there is a continual sort of lifelong process of finding your voice or your voices?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, the poets that I read now tend to be ones who have written written well into their old age. I mean, people like Thomas Hardy or Stanley Kunitz or poets who can continue to write interesting poems well until the time they're in their 80s or 90s. And, you know, and the great thing about poetry for me is it keeps getting more and more interesting rather than less and less interesting. And I just want to have, you know, more time, more years to continue to do it. And I think also a lot of poets tend at a certain point in their career to work so hard on their poems and try so hard to make breakthroughs in them, serious poets, good poets, that they lose the sense of writing as fundamentally a pleasure. And, man, I was well into my 40s before I realized that, you know, it wasn't always hard work. It was also something that even if I had a bad day at the desk, it was its own reward. It was a thrill. And I just like to move words around on a page some mornings, and that's never less than a delight, even if I don't get anything.
We're talking to David Wojahn, and his book is called Interrogation Palace. This book and other books by David Wojahn can be yours if you call right now, ladies and gentlemen, in the next 5 minutes, 428-1393 in the area code 505. 428-1393, and David will be speaking tonight at 5:30 at the Shaughnessy Performance Space at the College of Santa Fe. That's a free lecture and, I guess, poetry reading.
Yeah.
Are you going to be reading from this book?
Some from this book, some new work.
Ah, some new work. Excellent. So how often do you publish a book?
Oh, it depends. Sometimes I've gone, you know, only about 3 years between books. Sometimes it's closer to 8 or 9. So it's, you know, when a book's ready through some mysterious intuitive process, and there's just a lot of trial and error.
You know when a book's ready because you have some critical mass of poems that go well together and fill up a certain volume.
Yeah, and I think it's the question of whether they go well together. I mean, I've got the bulk now for a new book, but I don't know how to put the book together. So that'll be the next challenge over the next, you know, few months or a year.
So Matt Donovan has been sitting here quietly. Do you teach poetry at the College of Santa Fe?
I do. I've taught there since 2003.
So poetry and prose.
I teach in the Intro to Creative Writing class. We teach nonfiction poetry and fiction in that class. But I predominantly teach poetry in terms of the creative writing workshops, and then I teach literature courses down there as well.
So you've got undergrad. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say Matt is also a wonderful poet himself, and has published a terrific first book a couple of years ago that got a lot of attention, rightfully.
You didn't come on my show at that time. we hope you will soon. But when you have these young people, I mean, in their 18, 19, 20 years old, whose experience so far is essentially high school mom and dad, what did they draw on? What can you bring out of them?
In terms of the creative writing pedagogy?
Yeah.
Oh, I think, I mean, there are any number of ways to approach it. I think one thing that's so important is to instill a sense of it as craft and discipline from the outset, and that talent only gets you so far. We have so many amazingly talented students down at the College of Santa Fe, but this is a task that gives you pleasure, but it is a hard-earned task, and that the moving around of words on the page is something to be taken very seriously. That's an incredibly difficult thing to do. I think the other thing we can instill in them is just a sense of the importance of reading not only the contemporary work, but the great poets and fiction writers and essayists of the past too, and that we can teach them to find things that they can borrow from. We can teach them a sense of, you know, where the bar might be set, you know, appropriations and influences, and then a sense of the celebration of that continuity of voices too, I think is incredibly important.
Matt Donovan and David Wojahn, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And listeners, we just have a moment or two left. Please give us a call. I think it's been a bit of a slow show today. Maybe people are in some kind of slowed down poetic intake mood, but wherever you are, please consider supporting KSFR. Don't even consider it. Just do it. Support KSFR. Give a call, 505-428-1393. 428-1393. We're going to be here tomorrow talking about cats and dogs on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Meow.
I just heard one of the cats in the control room. Not sure how that cat made it in to our highly guarded space. Oh, dear. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte.
And hey, Mary Charlotte, before you get off the air, we do have Peter Green to thank.
Thank you,
for
Peter.
His great contribution.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you so much, and thank you to those who've called in other days and today. Please do it. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the jazz experience. The phone number here, 428-1393 in the area code 505. We come to you twice a year asking for your help. We need your help to stay on the radio. If you like the program, if you like the station, if you like jazz, whatever it is, please support us. Please give us a call. Hasta la vista. Ciao.